Standard Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, April is Hmong Heritage Month. We'll take a look at Hmong culture here in the state. First, President Biden headed to Pittsburgh today to talk about his proposal for rebuilding America's infrastructure and economy, calling it the American Jobs Plan. It's the week in Washington. We'll look at what we know about the plan and its future in Congress. Plus, we'll look at the administration's response to pressure about how it's handling the border with Mexico. And we'll check out the president's first slate of federal judicial nominees. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How big a deal is a big federal infrastructure deal to you? What questions do you have about how the president's priorities fit into this proposal, how he thinks it can be funded? What would you like to see congressional representatives talk about when they get a chance to work on this package? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Turkle is Washington Bureau Chief for HuffPost. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, we have another big price tag item here on this federal package, about $2 trillion. That's over the course of a decade or so. Can you talk about the broad strokes of this plan as far as we know it?
Sure. So this is the White House's infrastructure plan. And it is, you know, sort of the biggest chunk. About $600 billion is going to go for transportation, with a lot of it going to the electric vehicle market. But there's a lot more in here. There's money for broadband, upgrading U.S. power infrastructure, money for schools, community colleges, childcare facilities, safer drinking water. This plan is, I think that you talk to people on both sides of the aisle and they say that they agree that America's infrastructure, roads, bridges, and things like that, not only do you create jobs by investing money in this, but they're just badly in need of repair. I mean, I think any of us who go on like a long trip can just see the roads and bridges and everything like that, that they're just crumbling and need updating. And this is something that Obama wanted to do, Trump wanted to do, but they just haven't been able to sort of get enough votes to really push through an ambitious package. And so Biden's obviously going to have a tough time too. He's already getting quite a bit of resistance from Republicans, particularly about how it would be paid for. And he's getting some pushback from some Democrats who say that it honestly doesn't go far enough for what they would like to see.
Let's look at each of those concerns. First of all, how it's paid for. The Biden plan, the administration is hoping for some tax increases, I believe, on corporations. What kind of things are they looking for here?
Yeah, so like you said, they're looking to increase taxes on corporations. They would give the IRS more enforcement power to sort of, right now the IRS often does not sort of go after people who don't pay their taxes. The minimum tax on corporations would increase from 21%. Sorry, the increase, the corporate tax rate would go from 21% to 28%, plus what they're calling a global minimum tax. Corporate inversions to tax havens would be made more difficult. Tax breaks and subsidies to the fossil fuel industry would end. The stepped up enforcement from the IRS on corporations who aren't paying their taxes. So, this is not hitting sort of poor Americans, working Americans as much. This is going after corporations and higher income Americans. Republicans are saying this is a non-starter. They are not in favor of increasing taxes. The Chamber of Commerce has also come out against this, and they've actually been fairly supportive of a lot of what Biden has done, even though they are traditionally lean more Republican and more conservative. So Republicans don't like the tax part of this, but they also say that some of this in here, the investments in childcare, education, for example, just aren't what they consider infrastructure. And they don't think they should be in this bill and that it's becoming a grab bag of Democratic priorities. Although I think that if you talk to the Biden administration, they have sort of a larger view of what infrastructure is, and that includes human infrastructure and those building blocks that we need to keep the society running.
Talking to Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for HuffPost, looking at the top stories in national politics today, including right now an infrastructure proposal being presented publicly today by President Biden in Pittsburgh. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there things in this that you support? Are there things you want to see when it comes to infrastructure spending? What do you think of that idea of thinking beyond roads and bridges and such and looking at things like childcare, rebuilding schools? Do you see that as an important part of infrastructure? Is it worth it to you to increase enforcement of and rates of corporate taxation, at least to help pay for this? Or do you not like that idea? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Amanda, you said there were some Democrats who say this maybe doesn't go far enough. What kind of things were they hoping for that isn't here, or at least in this current package?
Sure. So they particularly want to see more when it comes to spending on the climate crisis. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, obviously an outspoken progressive from New York, said that, you know, Biden is investing, Biden wants far more than other presidents have invested in the climate crisis. But she and others are saying that's not enough. The Congressional Progressive Caucus wants $10 trillion in federal infrastructure spending over the next decade, which is obviously more than Biden's entire infrastructure plan that he's putting forward. So, you know, they're not probably going to get that much, because I think that price tag would alarm a lot of Republicans and more moderate Democrats. But there are a lot of environmental activists who are a little disappointed with this, because Biden has put addressing the climate crisis at the center of his administration and said it is such a priority. But, you know, this is obviously, again, more than we've had in the past. But so I'm not sure if it will be enough for some of these progressive members to actually vote against it.
This is just one part of what the Biden administration has been talking about since the American Rescue Plan. There's also an anticipated second bill that looks at things like child care, family tax credits, other domestic, less infrastructure-y priorities. This one with tax hikes on wealthy individuals now and families as opposed to corporations. Do we have a timeline and when we might see more details on that?
That will be coming out in the coming weeks. And like you said, that focuses more on sort of the human capital part of it. And, you know, this will also get quite a bit of pushback from Republicans, and also, honestly, from some more moderate Democrats who say that the focus needs to be put on infrastructure and not all of these other liberal priorities. You know, what will be interesting is obviously both of these are important to the Biden administration and they sort of see them together. But, you know, getting one of them through the House and the Senate will be tough. Will they be able to get both? And if not, which one are they going to prioritize? Are they going to try to push them together as a package? Are they going to try to do this through reconciliation, which would require just a majority of votes in the Senate? Or will they go through a more traditional process that would require the 60 votes, meaning they would have to get some Republicans on board? The Biden administration has not talked about their legislative strategy yet publicly, and Democrats seem to want to do something aggressively, perhaps through reconciliation, but we don't know which bill will get priority.
If the goal was to do the normal way, a 60-vote majority required in the Senate, is there any sense that there's appetite from enough Republicans to do, I don't know, anything vaguely resembling what we're hearing today from the president?
No, there isn't, especially with the tax component, you know, how they would pay for this. Again, you could maybe get, you know, one or two Republicans who might be willing to be on board, you know, fixing things like roads and bridges and all that, especially for members of Congress, tends to be very popular in districts. Again, this creates a lot of jobs. Members of Congress like to go to ribbon cuttings and show that they brought these projects back for their districts. But, you know, the Senate, I think, would be really, really tough to get this through. And I think Democrats recognize that they would have to make some major concessions on what's included or how it's paid for. And, you know, the question is, would doing that then compromise some Democratic votes and make them lose some Democrats that they need?
We're talking to Amanda Turkle from HuffPost. It's the week in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a big infrastructure program as proposed by President Biden make it through Congress? Should Democrats aggressively push for that, maybe even using this reconciliation tactic so they could do it if they had all 50 Democrats without any Republicans in the Senate? Is there something that should be a priority? Do you want it to be just about roads and bridges, or do you like the idea of expanding the concept of infrastructure in this plan? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with HuffPost Washington Bureau Chief Amanda Turkle. It's the week in Washington. We're looking at the top stories in national politics, including the president's plan for infrastructure development. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Sheboygan. Joe, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Joe?
Well, thanks for having me on. As far as the infrastructure, I think it's a good idea to keep it to infrastructure, you know, roads, bridges, what have you. As far as start putting all these other programs that have nothing to do with it, it's going to put more, it's problematic as far as having the Republicans on board for it. Now, I'm a moderate, and I'm all for, you know, helping out regular people and all, but we've already have, we just passed the COVID, you know, help, which we already gave a lot of Americans help. But as far as, like, to give the IRS more power over regular folks, I mean, that's not a good idea. We've already been through a lot as far as COVID for the 2020. It was a really bad year. And people probably haven't been up to date with their taxes and all, but I'm all for, you know, for the corporations to start paying their part because they've actually had a free ride for the last 4 years with the Trump administration. But to start giving the IRS more power over regular folks, it's not a good idea. And let's keep it to where at least maybe we'll get some Republicans on board to vote for it if we could keep it to just infrastructure.
Joe, thanks a lot for that call. With that idea Joe has, keep it more stripped down, straight up infrastructure. Have you heard, Amanda, Democrats, maybe in the Senate, some of the famous, some more moderate Democrats, making that point? Like, hey, maybe we can get something bipartisan if we do what Joe said there.
So one thing I wanted to clarify, the IRS, Biden doesn't want to give the IRS more power to over enforcement of regular people. It's enforcement over corporations specifically. So I wanted to make that clear. And yes, I think, you know, what I think that point is going to be something we do hear from more moderate Democrats in the Senate. I'm thinking specifically, obviously, of Joe Manchin, who tends to, obviously, he tends to be a little bit more conservative and I think would be far more supportive and has made clear that he wants the Biden administration to try to find Republican votes and to make a package bipartisan. I think a lot of Democrats, though, are skeptical that Republicans will ever support anything that Biden does because they are more interested in obstruction and winning back the White House and don't want to necessarily go along with this. So the question is, you know, how much time and how much give do you do to try to win Republican votes, potentially, you know, wasting your time and not getting anything. And I think Obama learned this lesson. He spent a lot of time trying to win over Republican votes that just never materialized. And Biden obviously watched this happen when he was vice president. And so and there are a lot of people who work in the Biden White House who were part of the Obama administration as well. And their conclusion, they've said this over and over, is that the risk is not going too small. The risk is not going too big. It's going too small.
Thanks for the call, Joe. We'll go to Will next in Eau Claire. Will, hello.
Hi, folks. Thanks for taking my call. I think that the guest last points were a good one. I think that the Biden administration is in a unique, timely position, similar roughly to Roosevelt in the 30s. I think he should put as much as he can in there. It's going to help average folks, you know, that's his intent, and not count on Republicans at all. They've been very obstructionist in the last several years. So that is what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. And I've heard some things from President Biden, Amanda, that suggests that he is thinking of the precedent of the New Deal and wanting to do something sort of on that scope in 2021.
Yes, absolutely. We have heard FDR and a sort of a you know the New Deal invoked quite a bit. And you know, Biden has made the case. You know, Biden obviously ran as a more moderate Democrat, but he has made the case that now is the time to go bigger. You know, to go big in addressing the COVID crisis. His slogan is "Build Back Better." And so his administration, you know, again, they really watched a lot of what happened in the Obama administration when Obama put forward ideas that were bigger, that were maybe clawed back even before Republicans objected, just because they wanted to try to win Republican votes. So they said, let's not go as big. And they saw that ultimately it was futile because Republicans weren't going to sign on. And so, you know, having control of the White House, the House and the Senate, that doesn't come along much. And so I think that, you know, they know that could be gone and you know, that could be gone in a couple of years. And so they are trying to do what they can now.
Thanks for the call. Let's bring on one more caller on infrastructure and related topics. Gary is with us in Brookfield. Gary, hi.
Hi. Hey, the question or comment I wanted to make, and your guest will, I'm sure, echo this, is that in the reduction for the corporate tax rate, all the Republicans could talk about was the fact that the U.S. corporate tax rate was one of the highest in the world. But that's the statutory rate. The effective rate, or the actual rate that corporations paid in America, was substantially less than that, as evidenced by, you know, Amazon paying no tax. So, you know, what they really have to stop talking about, the fact that they're going to up the corporate tax rate, it's really not going to affect corporations. Because of all the advantages that they have, the effective tax rate that they pay is already very low.
Gary, thanks for the call. Amanda, is that part of what the Biden team is talking about, not just raising that the statutory tax rate, but the effective tax rate in part through the enforcement you were talking about?
I think that gets at the enforcement part. And, you know, I think that, you know, obviously, like I said, the Chamber of Commerce is against this infrastructure plan in large part because of the taxes. You know, the Republican Party has traditionally had a lot of support in the business community. But I think right now, you know, with the economy, what it is, with people struggling over the last year of the pandemic, there's not a lot of support from people feeling sorry for corporations, especially as I think, you know, we've seen story after story, statistic after statistic of corporations getting wealthier, of, you know, the wealthy getting wealthier and just the income gap widening. And so, you know, it will be interesting to see if this, you know, blows back on Republicans at all. But, you know, my guess is Republicans will try to spin this a little bit differently than simply showing sympathy for corporations.
Thanks for that call. It's the Week in Washington. We're talking to Amanda Turkel from HuffPost. Let's move on now. Amanda, you wrote a piece on the Biden administration, its goal to not deport kids as they arrive at the border seeking asylum, and the challenges they're facing living up to that goal. What are you seeing?
Right. So the Biden administration has tried to take a slightly different tactic than the Trump administration, which cited the COVID pandemic and said that we are turning, basically not letting any undocumented immigrants into the country to wait out their immigration proceedings. We're turning everyone back, and that includes unaccompanied children. The Biden administration, for the record, is still turning people away. They're letting in some families, but they are allowing children who come here without their parents to stay. And so what happens is that you come in, you are at a detention facility, then you are transferred to a shelter while you await going to stay with a sponsor or a family member. The problem is right now, there are just too many people coming in and they don't have the capacity to quickly move them from these border patrol facilities over to shelters, which are run by HHS, and then, you know, to the next step of being placed with a sponsor or family. And so there's this buildup at the border. They're incredibly crowded detention facilities. And Republicans see this as a moment when they can sort of get some political hay, say that Biden is being, you know, his rhetoric is too kind and too humane, and he's encouraging undocumented immigrants to come over, and he's creating this crisis. The Biden administration is saying, you know, that's not true. You know, yes, we're not trying to be like Trump on immigration, but this is not a crisis of our doing. This is something that the numbers started going up under the Trump administration, which is actually true. And they said that, you know, we're trying as quickly as possible to move people from these detention facilities into the next stages. But, you know, it is something that's getting increased attention from the Biden administration. And Vice President Kamala Harris was recently named to lead the sort of the diplomatic efforts to try to stem some of this migration.
I want to give a listen to President Biden in a press conference last week, asked about the overcrowding of shelters, saying, putting some of the blame on President Trump. Here's a listen.
He, in fact, shut down the number of beds available. He did not fund HHS to get people to get the children out of those Border Patrol facilities where they should not be and not supposed to be more than a few days, a little while. But he dismantled all of that. And so what we're doing now is attempting to rebuild the system that can accommodate the what is happening today.
But as you wrote in your piece, Amanda, it seemed like the Biden administration was in some ways surprised by the extent of the problem, the difficulty they were having in finding places for these kids.
Right. So if you talk to the Biden administration, they're saying they're not surprised at all. They knew that this was going to be a problem. They did everything they could to get ready for it. But there was only so much they could do because the Trump administration did not cooperate with them on the transition. You know, as soon as they took office, they did what they could. But the Trump administration also reduced the number of beds that were available because of the restrictions they had in place. And so getting these things back up and running just takes time. You know, Biden's critics and honestly, even some of his allies say that, you know, a lot of the criticism directed at Biden is unfair. But they do think that they didn't realize how difficult it was going to be and could have perhaps done more. Could have talked about it differently and could have had a little bit more urgency in addressing this problem.
We'll leave it there. Amanda, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Amanda Turkle is Washington Bureau Chief for HuffPost. She joined us for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics, including President Biden's $2 trillion plan to address infrastructure problems, as well as climate change and inequality in the U.S. Coming up after the news, a WPR reporter joins us to explain the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision to strike down the statewide mask mandate. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll get ready for Hmong Heritage Month here in Wisconsin. First, the Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down Governor Tony Evers' statewide mask mandate this morning. In a 4-3 vote, the ruling was along generally perceived party lines, with conservative justices making up the majority. Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
What was the reasoning from the conservative majority on the court, Laurel, for striking down the ongoing mask mandate?
Basically, the majority said that the governor wasn't following state law related to emergency declarations when he continued to issue COVID-19 emergency declarations and orders over the past 12 months or so. Basically, what the state law says is that the governor has the power to issue public health emergency declarations, but each of those declarations individually can only last 60 days unless they are extended by the state legislature. Now, none of the governor's COVID-19 orders have been extended. He has simply issued new orders when the 60 days expire, and they say that's not okay.
And what was in the dissenting opinion there?
The dissenting opinion really agreed with the primary argument from Evers and the State Department of Justice, which represented him in this case. And that was that these new orders were kind of for unique emergencies because the status of COVID-19 has evolved so much in Wisconsin. The threats have changed. So they said this wasn't really, you know, an instance of extending an order or issuing the same order over and over again, but rather issuing new distinct orders. And so the law about, you know, needing an extension from the legislature just doesn't apply here.
And the conservative majority, it seemed like, was careful, Laurel, to say, we are not judging on the wisdom or benefit of a statewide mask mandate. They said they were narrowly considering the mandate and whether it fits our emergency law in Wisconsin. Do I have that right?
Yeah, exactly. They were really very clear about making sure that folks knew through their opinion that they weren't trying to weigh in on really even the breadth of the executive powers in Wisconsin and whether those are appropriate or whether the governor has the tools that he or she might need to fight a pandemic, for example, but rather just what the state law says right now about emergency declarations, who can issue them, and how long they can be in effect.
So does that mean the statewide mask mandate is now out? It's not in effect right now?
It's gone. The statewide mask mandate is immediately struck down after this ruling. However, it's very important for folks to know that local mask mandates can remain in effect. They're not in any way, you know, changed by this Supreme Court ruling. So communities like Madison still have mask mandates. Other communities actually passed mandates in anticipation of this ruling coming down that would go into effect if some decision like this were to occur, places like Superior and Eau Claire, for example. So folks, if they're not familiar, should check and see what the local requirements are in their area.
Laurel, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joined us to talk about a state Supreme Court decision that strikes down Governor Evers' mask mandate. Now, Hmong Heritage Month starts tomorrow, so we're going to learn a little bit about the Hmong community here in Wisconsin. The Hmong are an ethnic group who live in southern China, Laos, Thailand, Myanmar, and Vietnam, and here in Wisconsin. After the Vietnam War in the 70s and 80s, many Hmong started coming to the United States as refugees, including Wisconsin. As of 2015, at least, Wisconsin had the third largest Hmong population in the United States. We're learning about our Hmong communities here for Hmong Heritage Month, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you Hmong American? Where are you here in Wisconsin? Can you share something about your story, your family's experience in the state? That's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Macy Herr is executive director of the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce. Prior to her work with the Chamber of Commerce, she taught educational psychology at UW-Stevens Point. Macy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. I'm happy to join you.
It's a strange time to celebrate anything, hard to get in-person events together. What kind of celebrations could people be watching for, virtual or otherwise, over the next month, Macy?
Well, you know, the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce is a proud sponsor of the Hmong Heritage Month virtual conference that will be taking place on April 24th. And it's being held by the Hmong American Center in located in Wausau. So that conference will be taking place.
And as I mentioned, Hmong people started coming to Wisconsin in the 70s and 80s. Can you tell us a little bit about the story of Hmong people coming to Wisconsin and establishing communities here?
Now, I do have to say, while I don't consider myself an expert, I have studied and done some research on Hmong history and, of course, Hmong culture and language. And so I can speak from that and, of course, from my own personal experience.
Sure.
The Hmong are a Asian ethnic group that have lived in the mountains pretty much of Laos and Thailand, much of Southeast Asia, but they did have a home country at one point. But when they lived up in the mountains, during the Vietnam War, there existed the secret war within that war. And, you know, many of the Hmong people were the ones who were, you know, the United States came, CIA, and said, you know, help us out, be an ally to us, Hmong people, and help us fight the communist powers. And if anything should happen to your people, we will help to take care of you. Of course, you know, there are some scholars who say that part of that is controversial, but many of us have heard it in this way. So, apparently, you know, things weren't going quite as the United States had hoped that the war would go. And many of the Hmong people, their villages were destroyed. And ultimately, the Hmong people came over to the United States as political refugees.
Talking to Macy Herr, Executive Director of the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce. Next month, starting tomorrow, is Hmong Heritage Month. Macy, could you tell us about your work, the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce, and you how you help boost Hmong business startups and ongoing businesses around the state?
Sure. So, you know, the Hmong came to the United States, as you had mentioned, and from the time that the Hmong arrived in Wisconsin and really other places as well, they wanted to, you know, start some businesses of their own. And they would go to some traditional banks, for example, and just didn't feel that they received the help that they were, that they wished that they would have gotten, and that, you know, it was different when they had a different culture. And in their own words, they just didn't feel they were taken seriously. So, you know, they decided ultimately that they needed to have a place that would listen to them, understood who they were as a people, and provided them assistance that they needed, whether that be technical assistance or financial resources. So the Hmong Chamber of Commerce was born out of that. And I happened to be the daughter of an entrepreneur who ran into some of those same challenges. And so, you know, I'm fortunate to be in a place now where I am actually I'm leading an organization that I wish would have been around and for someone like my father. So we do two main things here at this office. We serve statewide. Main office is in Milwaukee. We have a satellite office in Wausau. There's six of us staff. And we do two main things, as I mentioned. We provide financial resources to economically underserved communities, primarily the AAPI or Asian American Pacific Islander community, but also outside of that. And then we also provide what we consider technical assistance. So, you know, providing the resources for business startup or entrepreneurs, you know, just to give them a sense of what they need to do to make their dreams happen.
And can you talk some about the ways the Hmong community and Hmong businesses have built relationships and bridges with the communities that they ended up settling in around the state?
Sorry, one more time.
Oh, sorry. Could you talk about just how the Hmong community is connected with the communities they live in, Wausau, Eau Claire, and elsewhere?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say that the Hmong community is an integral part of this state. They've given us so much, not only economically, they've, you know, certainly contributed to the diversity of the communities. I would say, you know, we know that research tells us that any time there's diversity, you know, there's success, whether that be in the work environment or in those communities. It just enriches, you know, every aspect of our where we reside. They've started businesses all over the state of Wisconsin and, of course, around the nation where the Hmong communities exist. They have certainly provided, certainly have had like celebrations, different types of events. They've served on community boards and committees, contributed in many different ways. And of course, you know, in the professional realm, all different fields.
We're talking to Macy Herr, Executive Director of the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce. Tomorrow marks the beginning of Hmong Heritage Month in the United States. And we're talking about Hmong communities here in Wisconsin. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Do you have a story to share about your own part of the state? Do you have a celebration in mind for Hmong Heritage Month? Or do you have a question for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce Executive Director Macy Herr. As Hmong Heritage Week kicks off tomorrow, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Joe is with us in Eau Claire. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi. I had a question about the population spread of Hmong in Wisconsin. I know that there's a fairly strong population in Eau Claire, and the Hmong community has been really important in supporting and developing a community radio station in Eau Claire. And I was just curious what the population
sure.
density was like around the state.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Where, Macy, around the state do we see a lot of Hmong Americans living?
It's a good question, and thanks for the question. You know, the majority of Hmong in the state of Wisconsin still reside in Milwaukee. Obviously, Wausau has a pretty sizable population, you know, and as you mentioned, in Eau Claire, and there's certainly a lot of activity, exciting stuff going on in Eau Claire when it comes to the Hmong community there. There's also populations of Hmong in Green Bay, Oshkosh, in Appleton, Wisconsin Rapids, La Crosse, and certainly a population of Madison for the most part. And I'm sure I'm missing others. Oh, and Stevens Point. And of course, a little bit of everywhere else in between. The last numbers I saw were probably closer to, I'm sure there's probably over 50,000 Hmong now living in the state of Wisconsin.
Joe, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to talk a little bit about the pandemic, Macy. We've seen a lot of minority groups in the state and around the country hit harder by the disease and then difficulties in some cases reaching out to communities with vaccines. What have you been hearing from the Hmong community around the state?
You know, I mean, there are different perspectives. You know, there are some individuals and mostly some of the elders who are skeptical about receiving the vaccination. And then there are others who are all for it. You know, why not? It's no different, some feel, you know, than receiving a flu vaccination. So, you know, I think the community as a whole, especially the professionals, have been going out there and saying it's okay, you know, to the Hmong community. It's okay. Look, I've gotten the shot. I'm doing okay. You know, let's help us all out as a larger community to get over this.
And unfortunately, we've seen in the news a lot lately instances of hate crimes targeting Asian American and Pacific Island descended people in the United States. Is this something you've experienced in the last year in the Hmong community in Wisconsin, or maybe it's not a new problem? I don't know. What have you seen?
You know, Rob, you know, I personally have not, knock on wood, experienced it yet, but I have heard many of our businesses experience AAPI, you know, hate related incidences and violence. We've had, you know, those who have had their buildings or their vehicles vandalized. You know, so we've heard of those kinds of things happening. I do have to tell you, though, it's you know, it's you got to think twice or three times before you step outside the house or really any building or staying out later just out of fear that that might happen. It isn't just happening everywhere else outside of Wisconsin. That sort of violence and or crime is happening right here in Wisconsin.
We're talking to Macy Herr, Executive Director of the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce, kicking off Hmong Heritage Month tomorrow. By the way, on Friday, we'll explore one part of that heritage, Hmong food, Hmong cuisine with a chef. That's on Food Friday this week. And Macy, are there cultural traditions that you'd like that you remember from your family or that you see people observing that you'd like to tell people about?
You know, one of the most important traditions is really, I mean, people love coming out to celebrate New Year's. Obviously, it's not New Year's time right now. It usually happens closer to between, November into the end of the calendar year. But, you know, New Year's is probably the most celebrated. There's traditional singing, of course, the foods, just being together with family and friends after a whole year of working out in the fields traditionally, and just spending time together, just celebrating the language, the culture, the people.
And one bummer, of course, over this last year, so many traditions from so many backgrounds, COVID kind of changed them and disrupted them. Did you have virtual celebrations of that sort this year?
Yes, actually, we did. This past year, there was some virtual New Year's throughout the state of Wisconsin and other places too. But I believe there were several virtual Hmong New Year events that were very successful. People still felt the need to come together some way, and so just this ability to come together virtually was still very, very important.
Let's bring on another caller now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. About 25 years ago, I worked at Kennedy Heights Community Center in Madison, where there was a large Hmong population. And before I left there, I received as a gift from one of the elderly Hmong women, it was a hand-stitched, what she said was a calendar. It represented the animals. And it's one of my most prized possessions. It is absolutely beautiful. And it's a place of prominence in my home. And as far as all of the violence happening to Asian people and the Hmong people, I definitely make sure and take the time to educate people about, why the Hmong are here, and because there's so much misunderstanding around that. And I hope more people will speak up and clarify that ignorance, which I know your guest did. But that hand-stitched piece is absolutely beautiful, and I just love it.
Lisa, thanks a lot for that call. And to her second point, Macy, about the importance, do you hope that people around Wisconsin learn more about the Hmong story here in the state?
Most certainly. It's so important, especially during this time when we can't come together, the way that we would have liked, we would have done in the past. I think it's all of our responsibility to continue to tell each other about why the Hmong people are here. I advocate for it being included in more so in our educational curriculum. That's so, so important. I'm still amazed, having been here in the United States for over 40 years, that there are people who don't know who the Hmong are and why we're here. And I think it's so important that it's included, like I said, starting with not only in our homes and our communities, but most certainly in our schools.
Lisa, thanks for that call. In our last minute or so, Macy, I assume Hmong businesses were affected by COVID like any business in the state. With the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce, what kind of things are you looking at in 2021 when it comes to recovering, helping business people recover from COVID?
Well, there are certainly still businesses that are trying to recover. It's actually only now, out of everything we saw last year, we actually didn't see, at least not here at the chamber, many closings. People were holding on for dear life to keep their businesses open. Somehow they were able to make it through. But I did start seeing a few businesses start to close fairly recently, or sale signs. They're selling their businesses. And on the flip side, it's people are feeling very hopeful, actually more so than people calling to ask for help to get out of COVID-19. Not that that's not no longer an issue. We're actually seeing a lot of people inquiring about starting new businesses. So I expect that those numbers are going to go up.
Macy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Macy Hur is Executive Director of the Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce. She joined us for a look at Hmong Heritage Month, which starts tomorrow. I said munch because coming up on Food Friday at this time, we'll check out Hmong Cuisine, a chef shares recipes that we can try at home. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, church membership continues to decline in the U.S., with more people saying they are unaffiliated with organized religions. A sociologist joins the show for a look at that, and you could share your own story. A lot of people face harassment and threats online. A new report tells us who's being hit the hardest. One of the study's authors joins the show. You can join in with your experiences and maybe your ideas to help solve that problem. When Congress got rid of budget earmarks, the practice had a bad reputation for wasteful spending. Now it's coming back as a potential savior of bipartisan compromise. We'll check out the two sides of pork. And vaccines keep rolling out, and there's new evidence that they're safe and effective for teens. We'll get the latest on that and some of the other news from the COVID vaccination campaign. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Last week on Food Friday, we got some great recipes and cooking advice from cookbook author Julia Tershin. We've got some of those up still at WPR.org/Food Friday, including one for an orange and Greek yogurt cake. During the show, I said I might make it over the weekend. Now, I say that from time to time on Food Friday, and I don't usually report back to you about that. So you might be thinking, sure, Mr. Big Talker, you talk big when you're on the air, but do you really make that food? Well, sometimes you're right. I am more ambitious in the moment than I am on the weekend. But a lot of times I really do go on to make the thing. In this case, I made the cake, the orange Greek yogurt cake. The verdict? Well, I made a substitution that came out okay, but not as good as it should have been. I did two substitutions, actually. I substituted blood orange in for the regular orange. That was good. I have blood orange around my store. My grocery store has them all the time. I love them. I'm nuts about the things. But substitution two. I used the yogurt I had, low-fat regular yogurt, instead of full-fat Greek yogurt. It's okay. I slice it, I toast it, I put butter on it. It's pretty good, but yeah, clearly that was a substitution that I should not have made. Next time, it's the full-fat Greek yogurt. You can try it yourself, and yours will be better than mine. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. This is Central Time.